Joshua chapter 16. The allotment for Joseph began at the Jordan of Jericho, east of the waters of Jericho, and went up from there through the desert into the hill country of Bethel. It went on from Bethel, that is Luz, crossed over the territory of the Arkites to Atarot, descended westward to the territory of the Jephthahites, as far as the region of the lower Beit Horon, and on to Gezer, ending at the sea. So Manasseh and Ephraim, the descendants of Joseph, received their inheritance. This was the territory of Ephraim, clan by clan. The boundary of their inheritance went up from Atarot Adar in the east of the upper Beit Horon and continued to the sea. From Mikmatat on the north, it curved eastward to Ta'anat Shiloh, passing by the Genoa on the east. Then it went down from Genoa to Atarot and Na'ara and touched Jericho and came out at the Jordan. From Tapua, the border went west to the Kana Ravine and ended at the sea. This was the inheritance of the tribes of the Ephraimites, clan by clan. It also included all the towns and their villages and were set aside for the Ephraimites within the inheritance of the Manassites. They did not dislodge the Canaanites living in Gezer. To this day, the Canaanites live among the people of Ephraim, but are required to do forced labor. Chapter 17. This was the allotment for the tribe of Manasseh as Joseph's firstborn, that is, for Machir, Manasseh's firstborn. Machir was the ancestor of the Gileadites, who had received Gilead and Bashan because the Machirites were great soldiers. So this allotment was for the rest of the people of Manasseh, the clans of Abiezer, Helek, Asriel, Shechem, Hefer, and Shemidah. These are the other male descendants of Manasseh, son of Joseph, by their clans. Now Zelophehad, son of Hefer, and the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, but only daughters, whose names were Malah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. They went to Eleazar the priest, Joshua son of Nun, and the leaders and said, "The Lord commanded Moses to give us an inheritance among our brothers." So Joshua gave them an inheritance along with the brothers of their father according to the Lord's command. Manasseh's share consisted of 10 tracts of land besides Gilead and Bashan east of the Jordan. Because the daughters of the tribe of Manasseh received an inheritance among the sons. The land of Gilead belonged to the rest of the descendants of Manasseh. The territory of Manasseh extended from Asher to Mikmatat, east of Shechem. The boundary ran southward from there to include the people living at En-Tapua. Manasseh had the land of Tapua, but Tapua itself on the boundary of Manasseh belonged to the Ephraimites. Then the boundary continued south to the Kana Ravine. There were towns belonging to Ephraim lying among the towns of Manasseh. But the boundary of Manasseh was the northern side of the ravine and ended at the sea. On the south, the land belonged to Ephraim, on the north to Manasseh. The territory of Manasseh reached the sea and bordered the Asher on the north and Issachar on the east. Within Issachar and Asher, Manasseh also had Beit Shan, Ibleam, and the people of Dor, Endor, Ta'anach, and Megiddo, together with their surrounding settlements. The third in the list is Naphtoh. Yet the Manassites were not able to occupy these towns, for the Canaanites were determined to live in that region. However, when the Israelites grew stronger, they subjected the Canaanites to forced labor, but did not drive them out completely. The people of Joseph said to Joshua, "Why have you given us only one allotment and one portion as an inheritance? We are a numerous people, and the Lord has blessed us abundantly." If you are so numerous, Joshua answered, "and if the hill country of Ephraim is too small for you, go up into the forest and clear land for yourselves there in the land of the Perizzites and Rephaites." The people of Joseph replied, "The hill country is not enough for us, and all the Canaanites who live in the plain have iron chariots. Both those in Beit Shan and its settlements, and those in the valley of Jezreel." But Joshua said to the house of Joseph, to Ephraim and Manasseh, "You are numerous and very powerful. You will have not only one allotment, but the forested hill country as well. Clear it, and its farthest limits will be yours. Though the Canaanites have iron chariots, and though they are strong, you can drive them out."
Thank you, Jeff, for reading that for us. Before I begin my little comments about chapter 16 and 17, does anybody have any questions or things that I didn't quite understand or am curious about these two chapters? A lot of territories, which isn't really that interesting, is it? Yeah, that's reality. It's not. The territory usually isn't that thrilling. It's like reading a geography map. It's great when it's in a picture. It's not so great when it's verbally written out.
There's no map of it even in the back.
It wasn't important enough to put it in the back of your Bible. That is correct. It was a fairly large territory. That is true. I have it in my Bible, but then again, it's not yours. any other questions or comments? This happens to be a different one. It's well mapped out regarding individual territories and locations regarding each tribe of what was allotted to them. Not all the tribes were successful in taking their territory, but it has the map that they were allotted. Yes, Rick.
Can you show us the significance of what it means for us today and those people there now?
I will certainly attempt to do so. It is not, unlike the, back a little bit, 3 weeks ago, last time, who was 3 weeks? 3 weeks ago. Almost four, yeah, three. The last time we discussed this, I was able to translate at least a portion of the names listing in cities for the tribe of Judah. I recall that vaguely as far as what was covered. Unfortunately, I did not type that up, but it still exists. It's recorded verbally. As I mentioned then before, not all lists of names translate into statements. And usually that is going to occur on things that raise red flag. As I mentioned before, they list 30-some-odd cities, and they claim they only listed 29. There's a red flag. Okay, what's going on? Hence, you can translate data and figure out what is being said by the author. And the author, meaning the person who recorded it, in the order in which it's recorded. And they could have rearranged names any record they chose, but they didn't put it alphabetically. They just recorded them down, and it happened to have data. It happened to make a paragraph or statements or sentences. Not all tribes do that. Ephraim's list of tribes and Manasseh do not do that. They list out the names. They tell you the exact how many they listed out. No qualms, no nothing. You try to translate the names. They don't mean squat. They're just randomized statements. It tells you that the author did not desire or was unable to record down information that was meaningful in those lists of cities because it didn't mean a whole lot. Meaning that they weren't trying to give you any information beyond that. So, to answer Rick's question, why is this important? What does this mean to us today? Yes, Jeff.
Well, the one thing that jumped out at me right away was all these mentions of they didn't get rid of them, they just put them under forced labor.
That is very true. Every tribe has the exact same problem.
Like God said.
Which is fascinating. It's not that they didn't have the ability to get rid of them. They may not have initially. That's typical of a tribe or territory that is young and new. It's hard to establish yourself and become strong. But over time, they had the opportunity, and none of them took it. They all said, well, yes, I could get rid of you and take your territory, or you could just pay me lots of money. Or work for me. Same principle. And every one of them took the latter option rather than the first one. There was no exception. Every tribe did it. They're more interested in cash, more interested in labor, rather than doing what God commanded them. Now Joshua got after all of them. We'll read that as his book concludes and as he approaches his death. He gets after all of them for not pursuing this, for not getting rid of all these inhabitants. So this was occurring, and this tributary style was occurring even during his own lifetime. It wasn't that it happened after Joshua's death. No, they started paying tributes early in order to, I will not give you motive behind it, but that's what they chose to do. So the reason why we cover this data, and the reason what it means to us today, is for learning, for us to see, all right, here is an example of God giving a person or a group of people, in this case tribes and territories, giving possessions to this tribe or territory, the territory as a possession to the tribe. And yet they chose not to take it. Too difficult, didn't want to, not worth it. That's the primary goal as to why this is recorded.
Well, this guy David says, you're strong enough to do it, why don't you do it?
Yeah, exactly. You're strong enough to do it, why don't you do it? Right. So that's why we read it, to learn, yes, this is not an isolated one person happened to do something. No, these are the whole tribe opting to not take possession, to not receive the full blessing God's given them, because it's not worth it, or they have something else in mind, or it's just too difficult right now, so we just won't do it. And none of the tribes were successful in doing this, in taking out territories and actually expelling the inhabitants. The kings were the only ones who were strong enough to do it, and most of them didn't bother or failed or had their own problems that show up, which we'll read as time goes by, we reach them. Yes, Ellie.
Isn't that, at the time of Esau, called hating your inheritance?
I'm not familiar with that term, hating
Esau,
your inheritance.
So it was said by God that he hated his inheritance. He disdained his birthright. He didn't want, he hated his birthright. Not meaning I hate it, meaning not caring enough about it to take it. And God
I'm not familiar with using that terminology as applicable to everything, but the same scenario is true, yes. In that you were given an opportunity, here is what it is. Take it, and you opt not to take it. Whether or not you claim that it's because of hatred, not you, me. Mm-hmm. Someone claims because of hatred is in Esau's case, or despise, actually. He just went despised. As opposed to just not willing. I don't know. You can argue it one way or the other. But yes, it is a prime example of the same thing. Now, all of us are subject to that. Every one of us do it. We have the opportunity. Well, yes, we should do this, but it's just don't want to. Too much work. I don't feel like it. Yeah, exactly. You know, I can do it later. The inheritance, the work that's associated.
It's not important right now, and as time goes by, it's not important.
Right, exactly. And it's human nature. We all do it. This is just an example, and note, the entire prophet section, as well as all the writings, is riddled with these examples of people. That's what they are. They're people. They are not wonderful, law-abiding citizens all the time. But they obey the Torah to the letter. That's rare, and they record the rarities called Moses, and called Ezra, and called a few, not very many, but a few of the prophets. They're rare enough that actually obeyed the letter. Hence, they get a whole book named after them and their own writings recorded. How wonderful this is. Out of the thousands and thousands, if not millions of people who lived, how many got recorded?
Yeah.
Not many. The few that, and they weren't perfect, but the few that did their best got recorded. And they actually have their writings recorded. Some of the tribes, that was not the case. Many of the people were just that, people. Good and bad, failures, goodness and weaknesses. Yes, Rick.
How many people do you think lived and were alive in that area, the population of those tribes and things?
Of those tribes,
in that area.
You mean, you're referring to the tribes of Israel or the Canaanite tribes that were in the territory, or both combined?
That territory.
The territory, all the population of the territory, probably less than 3 million people max, all combined. Now, that's not just a little sliver we call Israel today, I'm referring to the area which we would call Israel, and we would also call it modern-day Jordan and Lebanon, as well as a few other parts of chunks of Syria. That territory, probably less than 3 million, maybe as high as 4, I don't really know, but that's probably about the ballpark. The reason is, human population at that time was probably around 100 million people of the whole world. So you're not going to have large chunks in one little confined territory. Now, that's why I said 3 to 4 million is high. That's probably the limit of what of all the people that would be there. That's a lot of territory. And the reason I say it's that hard because it includes large metropolis territories as well. They're all next along the coastline, a lot very lucrative territory which people can dwell in confined areas and thrive, as opposed to, you know, Saudi Arabia today. You have 3 million people in any place, it's because they've been imported in. The land can't sustain that. Okay, any other questions or comments regarding these two chapters before I continue my own little spiel? Okay, then we'll go ahead and begin. By the way, I had actually prepped today to cover chapter 17 and 18. I had mistakenly thought we covered 16 3 weeks ago, and I was wrong. So I'm actually covering 16 again, as we did, as we had him read. Okay, the territory which we just read. I'll draw this map out to you real quick. I could pass this map out last time, but since I have a big board, I will use it. Now, 3 weeks ago we covered the territory of Judah, which was the bottom end of the tribe, which also eventually a small fraction gets taken away, subtracted out to Benjamin, as well as a portion is given to Simeon. But it'll... My little map. Galilee, and it's crude, it's big, it's blown up, but that's okay. General territory of the bottom three quarters of Israel. It did not include the other tribes which are further up north. We won't be covering them for probably a week or two anyway, so I'll worry about them later. We already discussed last time, Judah has from the tip of the Dead Sea over to the ocean. Benjamin, as I just mentioned, will actually get carved out a small chunk of Judah's territory as well, as they'll get a little bit more space up north. But Ephraim's territory in Manassas, which we just covered, is a little bit further north. I'm giving you a rough shape. It's not perfect. So, this is the interesting part. I write sideways, apparently. Sorry. Why did I call this interesting? I'm only writing these few tribes down. I'll explain what I've written, or drawn. The bottom section here down is Judah. Along here, I have E for Ephraim. And just north of them is M for Manasseh. And actually, it's half the tribe, because the other part of Manasseh is over here on this side of the Jordan. Note, as I mentioned before, Manasseh did not come to Moses saying, please, we want a tribe broken in two. They didn't. Reuben and Gad came to Moses and said, hey, we want to be on this side of Jordan. And Moses said, yes, you can be there, but you're taking half of Manasseh with you. It helps create family ties back and forth to where one side does not become isolated, as it was the case here. Note that when Israel took over the territory of Canaan, they took over countries before they even reached across the Jordan. Because they're separate countries, even though they're right next to each other. Well, this is a method by which Moses employed to prevent that from happening. They don't want Reuben and Gad over here all isolated by themselves. So you bring half Manasseh there, who were also happy warriors. They didn't choose any half. They happened to choose the half that was the strongest military-wise and the most number of men and the most hardened in battle to be up here on this side of Manasseh. They're very desirable people to have guarding you, to put it bluntly and simple. E and M, I have on the west side of the Jordan, both packed together. This is a complaint that Manasseh brings, as well as Ephraim, to Joshua. Verse 4 of chapter 16. Sit there. Grab it here. So the children of Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim, took their inheritance. seems like an innocuous minor point. Okay, yes, this is their inheritance. Sort of. See, they as a tribe took the inheritance of Joseph as one instead of as two. Manasseh, this territory here, which is Ephraim on the west side of Jordan, is actually the territory for one tribe. Not the territory for two tribes. They had to split it. The territory that was designated for Joseph is incorporated. Both Manasseh and Ephraim are stuck right there together. Hence, they come. Manasseh comes to chapter 17 saying, Joshua, we can't do this. This is one portion, one territory, and we're huge. We can't fit in this spot. Manasseh's pushing their budget a little bit. They're really not that big. But when you combine both Manasseh and Ephraim together, they combine together. Well, they are the largest tribe. Judah, as an individual, however, Judah's the biggest tribe. And that's hence Judah has such a large territory down the south. That was allotted to them. Ephraim and Manasseh, if Manasseh had not been broken up, they'd all been compact in this tiny little area. So the point is, in chapter or verse 4, chapter 6, 16, is telling you that they took the designation of the territory, the inheritance singular, of Joseph. Hence, in chapter 17, they talk about the fact that it's broken up, we have one portion, one inheritance for two tribes. This is not enough. We're too big for this. Hence the Joshua's complaint. But before I go too far past that, we'll stick with the first few verses, of verse 1 through 4. The territory that was conquered, you recall this, the last few weeks, months actually now, we've been going through the book of Joshua, we have territories and cities that Joshua conquered, right? Remember that. Does anybody remember approximate location where most of those territories are at? Cities and areas. Do we recall vaguely?
Next to the Jordan?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Very next to the Jordan. Well, no, this Moses conquered over here. Joshua didn't. But all the area that Joshua conquered was pretty much right here. The core, the heart of what we would call Israel today. Now, yes, there were times where they skirted up to the top, north of Galilee, took out a few kings up there, but they came back and that was an area they primarily conquered. They conquered and occupied this middle section, as well as most of Judah's territory, which is the base of this core area. Where, do anybody recall, or we'll learn as the weeks go by, where do most of the tribes, where are most of them located at? In the unconquered territory. Most of them get their inheritance along the coastline, along north of the Galilee, and Lake Kinneret, same difference. Along this territory, most of the tribes are located there. Territory that's not conquered. So we have, at this point, only five tribes actually own territory that has been conquered. We have Reuben and Gad on this side of the Jordan. We have Ephraim and Manasseh, which were originally one tribe, Joseph, but we're breaking them up into two for this discussion. And we have Judah. That's the territory that they conquered. That's the territory that they occupied and divvied up and separated out first. Why didn't the rest of the tribes get that territory?
They weren't strong enough.
Keep in mind,
major warriors.
That's true. They were major warriors. As I mentioned a few weeks ago, what was the unique characteristic of Caleb and Joshua?
Ephraim and Judah.
They're the only ones who lived of the spies. Of all the spies that went out, which we're going to learn in the next chapter, of all the spies that went out, all of them that spied up the north country are dead. If I am a general and I'm going to command an army, am I going to go into territory I have no clue about?
Nope.
Of course not. That's silly. I'm going to focus on territory that I spied out. Being Joseph, guess where he spied out? The territory from Joseph. Caleb, being Judah, guess what territory he spied out? The territory that went to Judah. All right, they were smart. They knew the territory they were going to, so they conquered. They divvied up the land that they were familiar with. Reuben and Gad had the fortune of being at the time of Moses, so they conquered the territory first and then said, okay, now let's divvy it up. Which was an unusual scenario, but that's what they happened to benefit from. What value is that? In having five tribes having their location and territory, and having seven not. By the way, we're excluding Levi at the moment, because he doesn't really get inheritance. So we have seven that don't have their territory. What does that gain? What does that present to the people of Israel? What was that?
Work to do.
Exactly, work to do. During the time of Joshua, they conquered this territory as a single country. All the men of all the tribes were together as one, fighting. This is about 7 to 10 years later when this territory is being divvied up. Some argue 14, but I'm not going to go, I disagree with them on that. When you have five tribes, most of them large, very powerful, established, and having territories, homes, and vineyards, whatever else you've got growing up there, what does that do to the rest of the tribes? Gives them free manpower. It allows the existing tribes, the five, which are the strongest and the biggest, the opportunity to donate, if I can use that term, their military men to go fight and clean up the rest of the territory, all as one unit, having a home base at home that gives them all the supplies they'd ever want. This is the richest territory, by the way, as far as, at least at the time, as far as supplies are concerned. Not necessarily food supplies, but at least military supplies. A lot of trees, a lot of areas you can make and build things as you need. And that's the territory which they have. It was a great strategic plan.
Right.
Establish, get the biggest ones there, yeah. Established, yeah. Then pool their resources together to quickly squash all of the other small territories. The plan never worked. The tribes never did it. They did precisely what they were not supposed to do. They became isolated from one another. You're not part of my tribe. I'm not going to bother helping you. This was a problem that occurred for the next 370 years that these tribes would not band together to conquer out these other territories. Hence, these tribes up north, and as well as a few down, even the stronger established ones, there were territories and sections that they never even occupied. Never bothered. It took the kings to actually unite the tribes together to come out and conquer them. Yes, Ellie.
These other tribes that haven't been conquered, their land isn't. Where are they living during this period of time?
The vast majority, I won't say 100%, but the vast majority. Where'd my marker go? I have a habit of that. See this small little dot I'm drawing here just above the Dead Sea? Called Gilgal.
Okay.
They camped at Gilgal for a long time.
All of the rest of the tribes together?
Most of them, yes. Not 100% were located right there, most of them. Now note that there were other locations, which, if you recall, it's been probably a month and a half, I talked about two mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And the modern day Samaritans believe that Mount Gerizim was a great, wonderful mountain, blah, blah, blah. However, archaeology proved that Mount Ebal, which was a desolate one, is where a temple of God was established for at least a few years. A few years, not a short period, that's a couple of years. They said over 900 and so on, clean, under 1 year old animals sacrificed in that one spot, because they found the bones of all of them. That's located right about here, a little short ways north of Jericho. So at least for a couple of years, one or more, a percentage of them most likely dwelt along here, which is the Valley of Shechem. Not all of them, but a percentage of them. So they had not all concentrated at Gilgal, but they would have been scattered in and around this one area, tight-knit group, which most of them would have been there. So that's where most tribes were located up to this point. Now note, Jewish scholars believe that it took Joshua 7 years to conquer the territory and then 7 years to separate it and divvy it up. I disagree with that. Personally, I believe, yeah, it probably took him 5 to 7 years to conquer the territory. That's the Bible was quite clear on. How long it took him to divvy it up? I don't think it took 7 years. It took a short period of time. Now, because, note, Judah and Joseph's territory were already mapped. They knew those maps for 40 years. That didn't take a whole lot of effort. And in chapter 18, Joshua tells all the rest of the tribes, hey, group together. come one, go wander this territory, record the data, come back, and we'll cast lots for the rest of it. I don't think that took 7 years to do. That's my opinion. But I don't think it took 7 years to do. I can be wrong, but that's how I look at it. So most of them are located right here where the core of Israel is at. Of course, we also have supplies being brought from Reuben and Gad on the other side. So normally you'd be able to assist in battle. The drawback is that never really happened as far as the tribes that were established. Well, and that happened. That's the nature of people, as I mentioned earlier. These are stories of people, not stories of perfect law-abiding citizens. Note, verse 9, it points out that another methodology, and also a, how do we call this, a drawback? Yeah, we'll call it a drawback. Of divvying up territory late, is that sometimes some territory boundaries get intermingled. You know, somebody said, well, I had this city. Well, yes, you had that city, but we need a little bit more space for this tribe over here. Well, but we don't want to give that city up. Well, yes, but we still need the territory. Okay, what if we keep the city, then you can keep the territory? Okay, they're happy with that. It happens all the time. So in Ephraim and Manasseh, there are chunks, just dot up there, there are Ephraim cities in Manasseh's territory. And in Manasseh, there are chunks, little dots up there, that are Manasseh's cities in Issachar and Asher's territory. Why? What does that gain? Now, as I mentioned, there's a drawback of carving up territories after they've been conquered, is that so some people just don't want to move. But what does it gain as a side effect?
Brothers.
Interaction in brothers, exactly. The same thing that Moses wanted by dividing up Manasseh. It requires family ties going back and forth.
No wars.
You can't fight each other if your city is in their territory. I mean, it doesn't work. Now, the Bible points out quite clearly that these territories, which were located in someone else's, cities located in someone else's territory, were not all conquered, at least not initially. They were conquered via tributes, but they were not conquered initially because, oh, it was in someone else's territory. That's not true. If you have the ability to impose sanctions on someone, then you have the ability to conquer them. That's a principle of existence. If you are dominant enough to say, all right, you pay me money or you're going to be our laborer, then you are dominant enough to get rid of them too. They opted not to get rid of them. There was no limitation. They could have, but they opted not to. Okay. So they did not drive out the inhabitants of Gezer as they were supposed to, verse 10, as it quite clearly points out. They're more interested in financial gain, via slave labor. This is a common problem amongst how many of us today?
Everybody. All of us.
All of us. The point, as I mentioned earlier, when Rick had asked his question, why are we reading this? What is this relevance today? To tell us information and make us realize to always be aware. We have the opportunity of God's blessing. Our unwillingness or inability or undesire, for whatever reason, we don't take it. Mm-hmm. It's a weakness of all people. These particular individuals of the Joseph's tribe in the category of Ephraim were subject to that. They were weak. They opted not to. Manasseh did the same thing. Judah did the same thing. Benjamin does the same thing. They all do the same thing. They all get territories. They're all saying, I'm just too weak. It's too hard. I don't want to. They were all strong enough to do it. They all opted not to. When you choose not to, you're on your own. God pointed out and told them all initially during Moses' time, would I let you conquer this territory? You'll conquer it. Not all at once. I'm not going to drive out all these people and instantaneously the vacuum void of no people, no inhabitants. He said he wouldn't do that because then the animals will take it over and you'll have to reconquer it from scratch. He said he would do that. He said it would take time. But instead of following through with the opportunity to do so, they fell short and opted not to for whatever their own personal reasons are. I continue on before I run out of time here. Continue on chapter 17. I'm going to discuss this without delay here if I can, as I delay to find the page. Important distinction, The promise in Genesis chapter 48, verses 19. The promise given by Jacob to Manasseh and Ephraim. We recall as he swapped his hands. One on the right hand on the younger brother, the left hand on Manasseh, the older one. And Joseph saying, no, you got it wrong. No, he didn't get it wrong. It was a blessing. That the younger would be older, younger would be greater than the older one. In this case, what have we just read as a prime example of that scenario in 16 and 17? The younger one got his territory before the older one did. Manasseh at this point is actually physically larger than Ephraim. But Ephraim gets the territory first. We're excluding the half-tribe of Manasseh at the moment because that's a separate scenario that Moses divvied up. So, in this case, we have a prime example of that prophecy coming true. Well, there's actually another prophecy in the same chapter that Joseph gave regarding Ephraim, which is one that hasn't come true at this point in time, but comes true the moment they crossed the Jordan River. The promise that they would be successful and proliferate. Ephraim would. Once they were in the land, Jacob promised that. They will fill up the land. But the key is, once you're in it. Ephraim at this point is not a very big tribe. It wasn't. Manasseh had almost, not quite double, but increased in tribe almost 70% this time, since the time they left Egypt to the time they crossed Jordan. Huge increase. And Ephraim stayed the same. Same size, same population, no increase at all. Once they crossed the Jordan, the tables started to twist. Manasseh's size stayed dead even and actually started to decrease over time. Meaning decrease on this side of Jordan. The west side, they were fine, but the east side of Jordan, because of wars and whatnot, they weren't that successful. Ephraim, however, started to increase. And as we know today, they have become, they were, they did become the dominant kingly tribe of the northern territory, all of the northern tribes. They became big, exactly according to Jacob's prophecy, that that's what would happen after they entered the land. It's fascinating the fact that it didn't happen beforehand. It happened after they entered it, not before. I think that's interesting, because it just matches almost perfectly with what he had prophesied. You have a comment.
Because there's always the discussion of who's Ephraim and who's Manasseh between the UK and the United States, we did not become large until we got to this country. And then we grew like wildfire, becoming larger than the UK.
Yeah, I definitely see that parallel. Yes, Richard.
What I was thinking about, though, is the history there is, in a sense, Ephraim gobbled up all of the others.
Yeah.
So, in a sense,
they became very huge.
All the two nations joined themselves together, voluntary or not voluntary, into Ephraim.
That's true. And that's actually the same scenario when occurring to Judah with Simeon, parts of Benjamin, and most of the tribe of Levi. Same scenario. Whether voluntary or not, they all became Judah.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is another prophecy we're going to get into next week with chapter 18, regarding a two-house prophecy that has occurred and is occurring again today in the tribe of Judah, and regarding the territory of Shiloh, which is the city which they're going to establish the tabernacle for the first 370 years. Mind you, a tabernacle meaning a tabernacle made of rocks as opposed to one made of fabric, which is currently what it is. God wipes out Shiloh many years later, but we'll discuss that when we get to Eli's story, which will be for quite a while. Manasseh split. The rules. All right. Verse 3, I think, is Zelophehad, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, only daughters. These are names of daughters. Rattled them off. Came before Eleazar and before Joshua. This scenario was actually recorded in the book of Numbers. It's recorded when they approached Moses. not Joshua at the time. They approached Moses with Eleazar the priest. This is Numbers chapter 27, verses 1 through 11. We don't necessarily have to go there, but I'm going to tell you what the story basically was. So Zelophehad and his daughter said, hey, we have no sons, but yet you're claiming we get this territory. Well, that doesn't work because we already read the law and you already told us it only gets inherited and passed through males. What do you do about it, Moses? Moses, all right, God, what do we do about this? Oh, okay. It will pass through the daughter until you are married, and your son, the daughter's son, not the dad, but the son, will be the inheritor of that territory. The dad is stuck with his family's portion somewhere else. Fair enough, they're stuck. Whether you like it or not, that's what you got. Now, some territories are better than others. So in here, in this case, a few years later, actually I think it's about a year and a half later, there it's the stories recorded again coming to Joshua and Eleazar, saying, hey, remember, this was the struck deal. This is how we're going to make this thing work. That we still get some of this territory. Now, you can argue, and many have, that only one of these stories is actually correct. The other one's incorrect. Either they came to Moses and Eleazar and not Joshua, or they came to Joshua and Eleazar and not Moses. The problem is, there are a lot of data in the book of Numbers that's recorded in the book of Numbers, don't think chronologically, but the same subject matter is duplicated again in some of the book. Happens all the time. It's quite common. That's the concept of more than one witness. We have the scenario four times called the Gospels. We have the same thing recorded. Did that mean Jesus came back four times?
No.
Of course not. He didn't die four times. It's just four different people recording the same data because they were at the same time frame. Now, some of them were born, some of them were a few years later, some were a few years earlier, but they just record the same data. Joshua, now it says, the reason I'm recording this is because it says it reminded Joshua and Eleazar. The term reminded there is actually not in the original Hebrew text. It's just, that's been added by English authors. I'm sure that might throw you there, but don't worry about it. You know, you can certainly, by all means, accept as the English text says, yes, it happened to Moses and they reminded Joshua. That's fine. I'm not arguing that point. The point is, if you go to the Hebrew and you note, oh, hey, there's a difference, there's a distinction here, what's going on? It's just two witnesses of the same event. It doesn't make any difference. It doesn't matter who was, quote, there or who was not there. Same difference. The point is, the Torah held true. The point is, the law regarding inheritance for women was held true. It was established and completed. This is an example of the fact that it was completed. Zelophehad's daughters inherited their territory. Judaism believes they got like six portions of Manasseh or something, four portions of Manasseh because of a dead uncle, but I'm not going to argue that point. It's a minor issue. But anyway, so that's Jewish tradition. Talked about some cities being located in other areas. Yes, Jeff?
The thing about Zelophehad and his daughters brings up one of those questions about I've heard some people describe it as the duct tape Torah, which is basically that the Torah had leaked so that things in here like this ruling on the daughters was like duct tape to patch the leaks. Another example would be the idea of the ketubah kind of fixing the thing in there about how divorces were handled.
Yeah, I could see where someone would come from that conclusion, or they could come to that idea. I think the inherent problem is that we as actually Western culture, we think chronologically. We think one event happens and another event happens. That's how we think. We live our lives that way. Our alarm clock goes off. We get up. We either go to the restroom or take a shower, whatever it happens to be. We have orders of things and events occurring. As opposed to saying, yeah, we have mourning. Well, mourning is a big, broad term. Well, biblically, that's how they write. we have the subject matter of mourning. It incorporates lots of stuff. Sometimes your mornings start early, sometimes they start late, but they're still mourning. Duties in the Torah, and actually almost the entire Bible, is written in subject matter format. If we're going to talk about the concept of mourning, it's going to be in a discussion of mourning. It may be mornings on Sundays, it might be mornings on Saturdays, it might be mornings on Fridays, but we'll all talk about it. And we'll talk about it right now. And we'll record the discussion of mourning. Does that mean mourning didn't happen before or after? Of course not. Mourning happens all the time. It's a subject matter data. That's how it's different than Western, which thinks of chronologically. Well, this event and this event. No. Events are big and broad. They happen all the time. So the patchwork idea or the duct tape Torah idea, it's because they're compiled together. They said, hey, we had this huge subject matter discussed at 10 different times about the concept of mourning. Let's combine them into one, two or three chapters. Then we're done with the discussion. Now let's talk about something else. As opposed to thinking chronologically, the Torah and the Bible, everything thinks subject matter-wise. That's the nature of the book. It's the nature of all the books.
So, just by extension of that, there is, you know, an idea that kind of goes along with the big discussion these days in our own Constitution about the idea of strict constructionist views of the Constitution. Basically, you go back to what the framers of the Constitution were thinking when they actually wrote it versus looking at the Constitution through our eyes today and trying to figure out what it says. You know, the idea of the living Constitution versus the strict construction of the original intent of the Constitution.
True.
And I guess the question of regarding the duct tape Torah is similar to that. Are the rulings and the Talmud and this and that and what we hear Messiah talking about, are those examples of, uh-oh, there was a problem with the original, so we have to go back and kind of fix the leaks? Or what? How do these rulings, interpretations, and stuff that have come down throughout time apply to the original?
Sheesh. It's a complex subject matter, I'll give you that. There's a reason why you have people that are paid mega bucks on radio talk show hosts and TV show hosts discussing such issues. It is well above my pay scale. I understand that. So I don't know if I can come up with a definitive example of, oh, this is how everything should be interpreted or everything should be read. However, in my own personal head, which is only what makes sense to me, is that you will take a subject matter and say, hey, this is what I would do. And in my case, I would say, all right, because the Bible talks regarding subject matter format, anything regarding one subject is commentary on a law detail. So all those subjects, doesn't matter what time of year, what decade, what generation, all get grouped together into one ball and shoved under this little thing called that law regarding that subject matter. You may have a dozen different interpretations. If any of them don't fall underneath that law as opposed to above it or on the side of it, then they don't work. They all must fall underneath that law. So if any of them fall outside of it, that means you've misinterpreted your law. That's how I look at it. That's the only thing that makes sense in my head, though. So I can't swear to anybody else. So regarding Constitution or anything else for that matter, take every commentary there is at the time which it was written, or shortly thereafter, say, all right, all of this data has to fit underneath this rule that they've written. Let's find an interpretation of that rule that makes sense with all the data that's there.
Is that kind of an example of one that that Messiah was talking about was, you know, the interpretation that, you know, if you give, if you have a gift that you would otherwise have for your parents or whatever, and you give it to the temple, that would be fine. You're absolved from having to take care of your parents in their old age, as long as it was a gift to the temple. That took care of the honor your father and mother thing that you'd have to deal with later. So you, is that kind of an example of where you had somebody's interpretation
has fallen outside of another law?
Fell outside of what?
Right, right. That's what I would classify that interpretation as. It conflicted. It may have obeyed one rule, but it conflicted with a bunch of others. So, well, okay, if it conflicts with, that means your understanding of the other laws, or at least that idea, whatever it is, doesn't work. It either throw it out, redesign it, rewrite it, do whatever you want, but it doesn't work.
Because
it fell out.
Commandments of men.
Don't add, yeah, exactly. So that's how I would classify that. Now, again, this makes sense in my head. Anybody else, you're on your own. Like I said, it's above my pay scale by a long shot. To any of these guys, wow, if I just one day, that would be thrilling. But so I'm not an authority on the issue. But regarding the Bible, that's how I look at it. So if it falls outside, I misunderstood something. I had to find something that makes sense where it falls back inside, under the law, where it belongs. Move on, because I'm past my time. And he even gave me all of his Torah section, too. Go figure. All right, let's try this. Oh, Joshua's response. I like Joshua. I always have. I think he's a great person. Manasseh and Ephraim say, hey, wait a minute. This is so not big enough. Because their argument, you gave us the area of Joseph, and then you divide it into two. And our tribes are so big, you can't do that. You have to give us both independent sections as individual tribes. He didn't do that. What was his response? Go get it.
If you can take it, you can.
It's
have
yours.
It.
Territory of Ephraim. Yeah, he points out the mountain of Ephraim or mountains of Ephraim, which we know topographical map of Israel. There's a huge mountain range going on. It's not really tall, but it's there. It's a pretty good sized mountain range going down the spine of it. Ephraim and Manasseh had the wonderful fortune of owning most of that territory. So there's mountains along here, this whole range and whatnot, various mountain sizes. What was Manasseh and Ephraim so upset with? Was it the territory size? Or was the fact it was, yeah, it was mountains? but the people who owned the cities in the valleys have chariots. I don't want. Come on, we need something bigger. This isn't fair. That's true. They weren't. That's what we need in marketing. So their complaint, at least for the most part, was the territory that was lush and green and wonderful was already occupied by people who were stronger than they were. At least they thought they were strong at the time because they had iron chariots. We discussed earlier, for some reason God has an issue with chariots and horses, but we won't discuss that again. It's an odd thing, which the Bible, I don't understand it that clear yet. Just that anytime there's a chariot, he says burn it. Anytime there's a horse for a chariot, he says hamstring the horse, so it cannot carry chariots. That's the law. All kings, everybody's got to operate the same law. It's open to interpretation. If you've got a good reason why God has something against chariots and horses, by all means, let it loose. But I'm not going to discuss it today. So the territory of Ephraim and Manasseh, it wasn't that the territory was too small. No, today, how many people live in this territory? A lot.
Yeah.
A lot of people. A whole lot bigger than just a few tens of thousands. But we're talking borderline millions live in this territory. Is it too small? If you can fit that many people in it, not so bad. It may not be some wonderful ability to produce lots of crops for all these millions of people. But at this time, the territory was plenty big enough for Manasseh and Ephraim. Plenty large enough. They just didn't want the mountains. They want a nice, pretty land.
Yeah, it's too hard to farm the mountains.
Yeah, that's true it is. It's too hard to farm the mountains. That's so much work. Note, we even read in both in for Joseph in chapter 16 and Manasseh in chapter 17 that there were cities they didn't bother taking. They could have. What'd they choose? That's so much work. I don't want to do that. Come on. I want a nice, big, pretty valley. No, it didn't work that way. Joshua's response was, hey, you know what? If the mountain of Ephraim, meaning this mountain range, the small one, is too small for you, that's fine. You can go ahead and get bigger territory. Meaning go conquer the rest of your own land. It's called the other mountains. You have them. Go conquer them. So did they get a bigger space? No. They had the same space they were originally allotted. Why didn't Joshua just say, okay, fine, I'll give you a little bit more space up north? Say it again? Well, not at this point it wasn't. It will be Issachar's, but at this point it wasn't Issachar's. What's the inherent problem of saying, okay, I'm going to give you more than your portion?
Oh, jealousy. Jealousy.
You're doing a lot of things against God's law. Now, Joshua was commanded, you're supposed to follow the Torah to the letter. So read it and study it. And so he did. If he said, all right, yes, you've been allotted this, you cast lots, and this is your territory, and Joshua tells him, all right, we'll give you a little bit more, you're actually usurping God.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to do that. And Joshua knew that. He knew it wasn't right. Yes, you have a comment.
In kind of two ways, I think, because as he said to him, okay, you're going to have to take the ground that's there. God told them to take that ground and told them to cast them out.
Yeah.
And so if he had said, okay, well, just leave them in there and you can go over here, he would have been lining up with that. And
exactly.
Telling them that they have to take the ground. They
exactly.
The people out.
What territory do you think they were after when they were approaching Joshua with this? Well, what territory that's completely conquered looks really good, lots of valleys, and no one occupies right now? Soon to be Benjamin's territory, yes, includes Jerusalem. That's what they were after. Because down here, these mountains and these valleys look a lot better. Up here, not so great. A little bit more work. They were after more than what was allotted to them. Again, is this evil? No, it's called people. People are people. That's what they do. They say something's too hard. The cities that they were allotted, too difficult. I don't want to do this. Do it anyway. You don't have a choice. If you complain, that's how you got to handle it. Tough luck. So, I believe, yeah, chop down those trees. Note, of course, today it's a desolate land practically, not quite that bad, but there are very few trees. At that time, most likely, there were a whole lot more. In the comments, yes, Dave.
Back to the chariots and horses thing.
Yes.
It's not that God hates horses or anything like that. He obviously created them. But in reference to the scripture, some trust in chariots, some in horses, but we will trust in the name of the Lord. It's a matter that people put their trust in these things, because war instruments, that's their strength, that's their image, that's their whole thing. God went out and fought for Israel. He didn't need the horses. He didn't need the chariots.
Very true.
And so in that regard, because that's basically a world system, he's against the world system. He goes and does the fight. He doesn't need the horses and chariots. So that's why he had them burn and the horses.
Horses humstrung, yes. That works just fine. I will accept that because it makes sense. They point out that he is fighting for them. You're absolutely correct. Does not trust in chariots, so you're absolutely correct on that point. Note, he does not say slaughter the horses, just hamstrings them. So they cannot, note, what does that mean to hamstring a horse? What was that? Right, but what does that do to a horse as a result? Are they dead? They can't walk properly. They can no longer ride or pull chariots anymore.
They can't run away.
They can't run away either. But they're still alive.
Okay, hold
on. They're still functioning. They're still able to do various things as a normal horse would do, though they cannot haul chariots. Yes, Jenna.
That's a question. So there's lots of different things. Like, I guess, Yeshua returning.
Mm-hmm.
I always figured that the chariot was like God's ride, and we copied it. Like God's oil, we're not supposed to copy. And I always felt that, like that, when it said that in Scripture, that it was because we copied something we weren't supposed to copy for just everyone else. I always felt like it was God's
something
ride.
Above, something above, something important.
And the chariot. So if there was a chariot that, you know what I'm saying?
Either way, it was something that carried someone.
So I thought that's what it was. That's why we weren't supposed to copy it. It's like, as we're learning about the oils, there are certain oils you're not supposed to copy. They are right. Holy oils.
Right, used for particular applications.
Right, you're not supposed to copy it because it's his.
Right.
So I just, in my mind, it would
work. And that could be.
they took something that wasn't theirs, and it was something that was holy. It was the holy ride.
That could be. Maybe that is a possible explanation, in that it was designated for a particular application, carrying God or carrying a king, if that's along those lines, used in this case for battle and for killing.
Well, it would make people feel, like he had said, you know, more power, their trust there.
Right.
I mean, it was
trust.
A godly king.
And you could have a great point there. I'll accept that. That seems reasonable so far. Consistent. It does not fall outside of some law in the Bible. It seems to be pretty consistent with what we've gotten. Maybe God doesn't hate chariots. He just didn't want men to have it. That could be. Anyway, I am well beyond time. So if there are any other comments before I go ahead and call it quits, or issues, or something you'd say, hey, what about that? I think I've gotten all my notes. Yes, I take care of all of them except chapter 18, which we'll cover next time. Which is interesting, actually, because we're discussing something similar to what she just mentioned a minute ago. Thank you.